Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Viewers, this is the fourth episode of the 19th topic. In the previous three episodes, we have discussed certain verses of Surah Al-Qiyamah and the interpretations of these verses as well. We have seen how, in the view of Imam Hamiduddin Farahi, a very distinguished scholar of the subcontinent, these verses spell out the whole scheme of the collection of the Quran. We had also seen how well-grounded his views were vis-a-vis the linguistic style and construction of the Arabic language. And then we had seen how history also corroborates his view vis-a-vis various details. We had also taken a look upon the traditional interpretation of these Surah Al-Qiyamah verses and seen that it's Ibn Abbas' narrative, which explains these verses of Surah Al-Qiyamah, and which are exegetes like Ibn Jarir Tabari, Ibn Kathir, Zamakhshari, Razi, Abu Ja'far Tusi. They have taken this narrative to be an explanation of these Surah Al-Qiyamah verses. However, the explanation offered not only suffers flaws in its text, the way it has been described, but we have also seen that this explanation also cannot be reliably ascribed to Abdullah ibn Abbas himself. There are certain flaws in the chain of narration, which make us realize the fact that this is incorrectly attributed to him. This explanation is wrongly ascribed to him. Then we had seen that although the Quran gives us a principal statement in this regard, that the Quran, once it was revealed in various installments, it shall be brought together in a unified whole by the Almighty through the Prophet. But the Quran stops here and does not tell us how this will happen or what would be the medium. We had then seen in the last episode that if we look at the various details in which the Quran was found in the living tradition of the Muslims, it was read out, memorized, written, heard, and recited and taught, we had concluded the fact that the Quran, although it was not left by the Prophet in the form of a book, of a codex, of an officially compiled codex, yet it was transferred to the Ummah in its oral capacity in a unified whole. And then a lot of companions had also memorized, they had written their own copies of the Quran as well. So the Quran was found in the living tradition of the Muslims, both in the written form and in the oral form, and it was transferred by the Prophet to his companions, who were basically students, who then transferred this document or this text to later generations. But as far as a written codex is concerned, or a complete written book format document is concerned, this never took place at the official level. So this was as far as we had covered in the last three episodes. Now, viewers, today in this episode, we shall take up some questions which arise or which may arise in the minds of people vis-a-vis the view we have established, or I have endeavored to establish as the correct view in the interpretation of the Surah Al-Qiyamah verses. And these questions are actually based on certain narratives which are found in our hadith and history anthologies. They seem to contradict the view which Imam Farahi has actually posited, and he has demonstrated how the Quran itself has told us that the Almighty, once its revelation is complete piecemeal, it was revealed piecemeal in over a period of 22 years. Once this would be complete, the Almighty will bring it together and then arrange it afresh in a new sequence, and then this new sequence will be read out to the Prophet, and he would be required to abandon the previous sequence, and he would be required to adopt and adhere to the new sequence with the new recital. So if this is the conclusion which Farahi has drawn, and which we have seen in our previous episodes, it holds a lot of convincing aspects as well. And we had also seen how history corroborates this view of the Quran. Then, as I said, we will have to look at certain narratives which seem to contradict this view of the collection of the Quran, which, of course, is something which the Quran itself has stated. I have already taken a look at all the narratives that I'm now going to just briefly discuss before you in a lot of detail in the previous episodes. So almost in 80-plus episodes, I have taken a detailed look at each and every narrative which actually I'm going to discuss now. and which would seem to contradict in some form or the other the view that we have just formed on the basis of the Quran. So for details, our viewers are advised to look up the respective topics, which I'll just also briefly refer to. You can just look up lectures on those topics for more details. But today, here in this episode, I'm just going to briefly touch upon those narratives which seem to contradict, and then give a brief answer or a response and refer you to those previous talks. So those who are interested in detailed talks regarding the rebuttal and refutation and critical appraisal of these narratives, they can look up those talks, and those who would content themselves with this brief description or refutation of the narratives can, of course, just adhere or stick to what is being said today before them. So let me start off. There are primarily 14 narratives, I would say, and as a result, 14 questions which arise on this view of the collection of the Quran on Farahi. And there are 14 narratives which I would say seem in one form or the other, or in some way or the other, contradicting Farahi's view that I have just alluded to. Let me take them up one by one. Now, the first of these views, viewers, was discussed under topic 15, and that is the incompleteness of the Quran. We had actually discussed two narratives, one of them concerning the stoning verse and the other one relating to the suckling verse. And we had seen, while I was evaluating topic number 15, this was discussed under topic 15, that both these verses, which give us the impression that the Quran we have is incomplete, they have their own explanations that we need to understand. Now, as far as the stoning verse is concerned, we find there are two types of narratives. One of these narratives actually explicitly cites that verse, "Ash-shaykhu wa-shaykhatu iza zaniya farjumuhuma," which is famously "farjumuhuma al-battata," which famously translates as "the married man and the married woman, if they commit adultery, then they should certainly be stoned to death." This was the stoning verse. So there is one category of narratives in which the stoning verse is cited in these words. And then there's another category of these narratives in which it is just referred to without actually citing these narratives. So we had seen in those talks discussed on the topic 15 that as far as those narratives are concerned in which this stoning verse is cited, they are extremely weak in the description and to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and also the questions which arise on the text of these narratives and on the text of this verse had also shown that these narratives cannot be accepted. And as far as those narratives are concerned in which the stoning verse is just referred to and not actually cited by the words, we had seen that they can be explained by the view of Farahi himself, who has actually posited the fact that these verses which refer to the stoning verse actually are a corollary of the 34th verse of Surah Ma'idah, in which the punishments of Hiraba are mentioned, or punishments of rebellion and spreading disorder in the land, fasad fil ard, are mentioned. And he had shown how certain criminals of guilty of adultery, certain criminals, not all, certain criminals of guilty of adultery had been punished by the Prophet in accordance with this verse, which says that they should be brutally killed for their heinous crimes. And one of the words which were used in that verse was taqtil, which means to kill someone in an exemplary way. And stoning to death is actually that particular manner in which some criminals guilty of of adultery had been punished. So those particular narratives had been explained as well, that although they do not mention the stoning verse, but they are actually referring to what Surah Maida's Quranic verse has already stated, and therefore there is no question of the fact that the Quran we have is incomplete, and the notion which these narratives give is also incorrect. Now, as far as the suckling verse is concerned, we had seen that the suckling verse actually is reported by Aisha, and from her it is actually Amra who reports, and she says that among what was revealed in the Quran was that 10 known suckling drops make a person prohibited to marry, and he makes that person a foster child. Later, this was abrogated by a verse which said that 5 drops actually are sufficient to make a person a foster child, and therefore prohibited to marry. And then the verse and then the hadith goes on to say that God's messenger died, and the verse which mentioned these 5 drops was among what was being read from the Quran. So it says, "Fatuwfiya Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam wa hunna fima yuqra min al-Quran." So this actually gave us the impression that the Quran that we have is incomplete, because this hadith is actually saying that this 5 drop verse of fosterage was found in the Quran at the time of the Prophet's death, but of course it is no longer there. And we had seen how Imam Tahawi had actually pointed out how this is actually rebutted by the fact that we have another version, or a more sound version, again reported by Aisha, and from her it is actually Amra, and it clearly says that these 5 and 10 and 5 drop verses were revealed, but they were among those verses which were actually abrogated, which had been actually totally repealed. So we can see in the light of this explanation that as far as the incompleteness of the Quran is concerned, in particular regarding these 2 verses which actually tell us that these 2 verses were left out from the Quran, are not present in the Quran, they had been explained while we were discussing topic number 15. Viewers, let's move on to the next question. The next question actually relates to a narrative which we discussed while we were discussing the second topic, and that is that it seems from a narrative that only 4 people, all of whom belonged to the tribe of Ansar, had collected the Quran in the lifetime of the Prophet. And so there were certain explicit narratives which explicitly said that no one except these 4 have collected the Quran in the time of the Prophet, and there were certain implicit ones as well. We had seen in our discussion on topic number 2 that as far as the explicit narratives were concerned, all of them were very, very weak and suspect in their ascription to the Prophet. And as far as the implicit ones were concerned, though, they too had some issues. But primarily, we need to understand, first of all, that as far as the word collection here is concerned, it in all probability refers to memorization and not to a written collection. We had seen how various variants of this narrative point to the fact, and the usages of the word point to the fact, that the word jama'a actually here refers to a collection, a memorization of the Quran. So this would actually, of course, contradict many other narratives which tell us that there were people among the Muhajirun and other tribes who were also memorizers of the Quran. And this particular narrative, which tells us that only 4 people had memorized the Quran from the Ansar, would then contradict those narratives. Also, viewers, of importance is the fact that it is difficult for any person to make a list of all the memorizers. He can at best say whatever came to his knowledge. So either we have this option of rejecting such narratives which contradict other narratives, or we have another explanation which I had presented before you, which seemed very plausible, and that was the one which was offered by Hafiz ibn Abdul Barr. And he had actually told us that basically these narratives have become devoid of certain background details, and narrators have cut short this narrative and reported it the way we find it in Imam Bukhari's Al-Jami al-Sahih. But as Ibn Abdul Barr has pointed out in Al-Istiyab, he says that there was a certain background which we can see in some of the other narratives which he had pointed out, which told us that actually this was nothing but a scenario in which a debate of superiority, or a munazarat, as we call it in Arabic, would usually take place between the tribes of the Aus and the Khazraj, who were both Ansar tribes. So the Khazraj tribe, actually, while expressing its superiority, had said that we have 4 memorizers of the Quran amongst us, and in reply to that, the Aus said that, okay, we have other people who counter your claim towards superiority. So it was basically a debate between the 2 Ansar tribes, which is found in detail in other narratives, which was cut short, which was reduced in its background, and what remained was that only 4 people had memorized the Quran amongst the Ansar in the lifetime of the Prophet. Whereas, as I said, actually, it was a debate between between 2 tribes of the Ansar, in which the Khazrajites and the Aussites, if I may say, were engaged in expressing the superiority of one another over each other. So, whereas it was just a debate of superiority between the 2 tribes. And hence, we can clearly see that the claim that only four memorizers of the Quran, as is claimed by this narrative, again, is something which is wrongly interpreted, because, as I said, we know in this regard what the details are. Whereas the third question which arises or as a result of these narratives is a group of narratives which is actually found in Ibn Nadim's Al-Fihrist and in Suyuti's Al-Itqan, and which, if you recall, we discussed while we were taking up the sixth topic in discussion, and that is that we find that certain narratives ascribe a different surah arrangement to the codices of Ubay ibn Ka'b radiyallahu anhu and Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiyallahu anhu. We had seen that they are the surahs are differently arranged, not only from between themselves, the two companions, but also from the Quran that we know is with us and which was compiled as per the Quran's own specification in the time of the Prophet himself. So they have an entirely different surah arrangement. But we had seen, viewers, that the way they have been reported, not only the questions which arise on the text, but also their ascription to these authorities respectively is extremely frail. And when we were discussing topic number six, I had pointed out the flaws, and therefore this fact cannot be entertained. And the reason that this actually is important is that it is on the basis of this particular, one of the basis, I would say, is that people say that because of the fact that companions had surahs arranged differently in their codices, therefore the arrangement of the surahs of the Quran was something which took place in the times of the Caliph Usman. As far as the verses themselves are concerned, they were arranged in the time of the Prophet, but the final arrangement of the Quran took place in the time of the Caliph Usman. And before that, we had different surah arrangements, as they contend is the case that can be seen from these companion codices. And I had posited the fact that these narratives actually are extremely weak, not only in the text they report, but also in the chains of narration. And we had also seen a number of contradictions in this regard as well. The fourth question that arises is actually also based on a narrative which says that Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiyallahu anhu, who is a very famous authority and a very close companion of the Prophet, he did not regard the last two surahs of the Quran, which are of course Surah Falak and Surah Nas, to be part of the Quran. Now, the answer to this question also, viewers, which I had given in detail, and this was given while I was analyzing topic number seven, was that actually it is wrongly attributed to Abdullah ibn Mas'ud that he did not regard Surah Falak and Surah Nas to be part of the Quran. What in fact does seem probable and plausible in the light of all the material, if we analyze it, which is available, it comes to mind that the question which actually arose in the mind of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was whether the word Qul, with which these surahs begin, is part of the surahs, or is it a command which actually Gabriel gave to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam that he should recite. The word Qul means recite. So the question which arose in the mind of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was whether Qul a'uzu bi rabbin nas, is this the, or Qul a'uzu bi rabbil falak, is this the wahi that makes the surah, the first verse of the surah, or is it just a'uzu bi rabbil falak, a'uzu bi rabbin nas, because the word Qul is only a command from, it can be construed to be a command from Gabriel. So the question that he had in mind was that perhaps the word Qul was uttered by Gabriel himself as a command to the Prophet, and the Prophet then had to say A'uzu bi Rabbil Falak. So this is a question that merely arose in his mind, and which took the form of these narratives, ultimately taking the shape that perhaps he had rejected the Quranicity or the Quranicness of these two surahs. Now, viewers, the fifth question which arises vis-a-vis the view of Imam Farai is that we find there are narratives which tell us that right after the death of the Prophet, Ali ta'ala anhu went about collecting the Quran from various fragments. Now, these narratives are mentioned both in Sunni and in Shia sources. We had discussed both these sources in detail when we were discussing topic number five, and we had found that these narratives are not only reported in a very weak manner, and they are not reliable as far as their description is concerned, but there are a number of questions and contradictions which arise on their text as well. And what at best can be adduced, viewers, is that Ali رضي الله عنه had perhaps collected a personal copy for himself, or he had written a personal copy for himself, the way other companions and students of the Prophet did so. As far as the details are concerned, the way they are described in Sunni and Shia sources are in them, they are totally unreliable. Thus, we have the Sunni account, which tells us that Ali رضي الله عنه compiled the Quran, its chronological revelation or chronological sequence, and upon being asked by Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه that why he is actually delaying his pledging of allegiance to Abu Bakr, to himself as the caliph, and Ali replied that since additions were being made in the Book of God, so therefore he took upon himself to collect the Quran, and since the arrangement of the Quran was being tampered with, so this was something which occupied him, and as a result he gave preference to this task. So we find Abu Bakr to have expressed his satisfaction in this delay by Ali رضي الله عنه, and the Sunni sources are silent after this. But as far as the Shia sources are concerned, they tell us that Ali رضي الله عنه actually had brought over the Quran he had collected right after the death of the Prophet, brought the codex to the companions, who said that they already have the Quran with them, and therefore they would not need the Quran which Ali has brought. At this, Ali actually angrily went away, and he said that he would never see the Quran again. And there are some other accounts which say that the Muhajirun and the Ansar initially did not have a copy of the Quran. So when Umar became the caliph, he actually requested Ali to give them the copy so that he could make more copies of that Quran. But Ali refused. And at this we see that Umar was frustrated, and he embarked upon collecting the Quran with the help of two witnesses. So this is how the Shia account tell us. So viewers, we had seen, as I said, that while we were discussing topic number 5, that this Shia account and the Sunni account, they have been described in our books, they suffer from flaws which make them absolutely unreliable. And the only thing which at best can be gathered as an educated guess is that Ali actually went about preparing a personal copy of the Quran for himself, and that is all. Viewers, the sixth question which arises is actually the one that we discussed while we had taken up topic number 3, and that was that right after the demise of the Prophet, some time after the Prophet's demise, the Battle of Yamama took place, in which a lot of memorizers of the Quran were martyred. And this alarmed Umar رضي الله عنه, and he came over to Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه and requested him to have the Quran written down and compiled in a book form, lest with the passage of departing or demise of other memorizers who are engaged in fighting other battles, the Quran might be lost. So Abu Bakr, although he first hesitated, but then he was convinced, and then Zayd ibn Thabit, a young person at that time in his early 20s, was selected for the task of collecting the Quran from various fragments so that he could compile it in the form of various suhuf. I had shown while we were discussing topic number 3 that the questions which arise on the text of this narrative and the way it has been reported, because there are certain other secondary narratives as well which have been recorded by Ibn Abi Dawud in his Kitab al-Masahif, telling us that the collection was made with the help of two witnesses. So we had seen that how the primary narrative, which does not mention the methodology of the collection, but as well as the secondary narrative, which mentioned this methodology, that two witnesses were employed in making or deciding about Quranic verse. Both these types of narratives suffer from flaws which make them unreliable, and we had even seen that there is the personality of Ubayd ibn Sabbah, who narrates these narratives from Zayd ibn Thabit, and it is extremely unlikely that he would have heard this narrative from Zayd ibn Thabit. Our earliest Rijal authorities in Muhaddisun do not even know who Zayd ibn Thabit, who Ubayd ibn Sabbah is, and in all probability this narrative is munkata, it's broken. But of course, there were other flaws as well in this narrative, and those who are interested to look about, who want to more details regarding the critical appraisal of this narrative, can see the talks that I had delivered when I was discussing topic number 3. Here's the seventh question, which arises is because of the narratives which report that Usman radiallahu anhu in his own times actually faced this scenario in which Muslim armies were fighting in the fronts of Armenia and Azerbaijan. And it is reported by one of his generals, Huzaifa ibn al-Yaman, that Muslims actually fought over each other over various readings of the Quran. By reciting the Quran, there were differences, serious differences between the Muslim armies when they were gathered there fighting the enemy, and they had differences over reading the Quran. And this alarmed Huzaifa, who reported this matter to Usman, who was the caliph at that time. And then Usman summoned the copy of Hafsa, of Abu Bakr, who actually resided at that time with Hafsa, radiallahu anha, who was the Prophet's wife and the Caliph Umar's daughter. And he then made copies and then had them distributed to the various areas of his empire. And he, it's also, there are also certain other narratives which actually said that he went about collecting the Quran afresh. He did not use Hafsa's Mus'haf, and he just made a copy of the Quran, or he made a collection of the Quran, a fresh collection of the Quran. So I had shown viewers that these narratives also do not hold ground, and they are very weakly reported, as I said, while I was discussing topic number four. And we had seen how history books actually negate the fact that there was any dispute between the Muslim armies in reading the Quran. What is more established from history is that there was a dispute regarding the spoils of war. Some narratives say there was a dispute regarding the leadership between the two armies, the Syrian and the Kufan armies. But the fact that the earliest history books tell us that there was no such dispute as reading the Quran is very apparent. I had shown that to you. And we had seen that in this regard, perhaps what can best be gauged when we gather all the material in this regard is that Usman actually destroyed certain spurious masahif which must have been present, especially some of them which might have the chronological revelation of the Quran, or some of the verses which were in the chronological revelation present. And he destroyed those, and he also embarked upon, as a responsible caliph, in disseminating the Quran and in having it spread out in various parts of his empire. So that is all that he did. He perhaps destroyed certain spurious masahif. He had them, some of them written afresh as well, and then he sent them to various parts of his empire. And by doing this, he actually set right the arrangement if it had been tampered with by certain people. And he had also set right the consonantal text of the Quran, and he had also perhaps removed any abrogated verses had they been present in certain spurious masahif. So basically, Usman's endeavor, the way it has been reflected in our narratives, is again very questionable. But perhaps what actually happened was that he went upon destroying certain spurious masahif and also in disseminating the copies of the Quran far and wide to his empire. This is all that happened. As far as the transmission of the Quran is concerned, it went on in the oral form, that the way it was received by the first generation of the Sahaba. And this, inshallah, we shall also take up when we take a look at the transmission of the Quran in the next and the final topic. So this, as I said, was the seventh question, and this we discussed while we were discussing topic number four. Here is the eighth question which arises, and which also was discussed when we were discussing topic number eight, is that Usman actually exercised his own judgment in placing the two surahs of the Quran together, and they are respectively Surah Anfal, the eighth surah, which formed the eighth surah, and Surah Tawbah, which forms the ninth surah, or Surah Bara. So it is said that actually Usman exercised his own judgment while he was having the Quran copied in his times, and he placed them together, not because he had any guidance from the Prophet or from any divine means, but because he himself thought that the two are related to each other as far as their topic is concerned. And again, this is one of the reasons that there are authorities and our scholars who believe that the arrangement of the Quran as far as the surahs are concerned was something which took place in the times of Usman. And one of the reasons, besides the reason that I earlier pointed out vis-a-vis the companion codices which had a different surah arrangement, is this narrative as well, in which Usman is reported to have exercised his own judgment. Now, while I was discussing this topic in my own detailed talks, I had shown how weak this narrative is as far as its text and its chain of narration is concerned, and nothing at all can be deduced from it. So that is, in my opinion, the final word in this regard, that this narrative cannot be accepted. The ninth question, viewers, that arose, that arises, I would say, is that we find that there were certain certain variations in the copies which Usman sent to in his own times to the Muslim Empire. Now, while I was discussing topic number 14, I had shown how, for example, in Abu Ubaid's Fazail al-Quran and some of the other books, we find that there existed variations in the copies which Usman had sent. And we had also seen how these variations were accounted for by our traditional scholars as the fact that since the Quran had variant readings, therefore these were incorporated in various copies. Instead of incorporating them in a single copy, they were incorporated in various copies which were sent to the empire, and I remember I had counted them to be 60. There were 60 variations. But viewers, I had also analyzed that such was the trivial nature of these variations, for example, between a wa and a fa, very small variation, that these at best can be regarded, if they ever existed, to be oral or scribal errors on the part of the scribes. They cannot be grounded, well grounded and well argued that we take them to be variations which were actually by willful intention placed there because Usman thought that there are variations. I had shown in my humble capacity that all these variants, they are weakly ascribed, their chains of narration are weak and they have questions and flaws. But what best can be gathered if they are to be disregarded, the flaws in the chain of narration, then they were just oral, I would say, and scribal errors which might have existed, but in no way can they be regarded as variations which were willfully inserted. And readers can look up topic number 14 for more details, because they were discussed very comprehensively there. Because the 10th question which arises is again on the basis of a narrative, and this was also discussed incidentally in topic number 10, and that was that actually Usman, when the copies of the Quran were brought before him, he actually looked on those copies and he remarked that I see errors in these copies, and then he said, okay, the Arabs would rectify them by reading them. And the word that he uttered was lahan, that there are mistakes in the Quran. But as I said when I was analyzing topic number 10, that these narratives are also very weakly ascribed and they have questions. But if at all any explanation can be made, is that perhaps Usman was not referring to any mistakes. What he was actually referring to is that there were certain letters that were wrongly written in certain masaif, and since the transmission of the Quran heavily relied on the oral medium, Usman said, doesn't matter if these mistakes, these scribal errors are there. They have been written wrongly, but we know from the oral tradition, the strong oral tradition, that how they are spelled, how they are actually pronounced. So even if you leave them alone, it would not matter, because the strong oral tradition would take care of erroneously written words. And I also pointed out examples which Dani himself actually gave, and Imam Dani himself actually has given this explanation, that perhaps this is the most plausible explanation, that that alif or a ya or a wa at times have been inserted in certain places in the Quran, and they are additional actually. And these have to be regarded as scribal mistakes, of course, but they were not of any consequence. They were not even thought of any consequence or significance, because such was the nature of the oral tradition and such was the nature of these mistakes, that one would immediately realize that a wa or a alif or a ya has been mistakenly inserted. Thus, for example, we find la uzabbihannahu in the famous verse of Surah Naml, verse 21. So we have an extra alif here. Actually, it is la uzabbihannahu, which actually is a word from King Solomon saying that I shall necessarily sacrifice that or slaughter that bird. So we have an extra alif here. Then in the word sa'urikum, which is Surah Araf, verse 25, we find an extra wa. And then in verse 34 of Surah An'am, we find the words bin naba'il mursaleen, an extra ya. So basically what Usman in all probability was pointing out was towards these vowels, these extra vowels which has been inserted by the Sahaba when they had written the Quran. But then, when the copies were made, they were copied the way they were, Usman said, just leave them, doesn't matter if they are still there, because the Arabs, the way they know how these words are correctly pronounced, there would be absolutely no problem. So this is how I had endeavored to explain when we were discussing this 11th question under the 9th topic. Viewers, now we come to the 11th question. Actually, previously we were discussing the 10th question, and that the 10th question was actually discussed under the 10th topic. The 11th question, viewers, that arises is discussed when we were discussing topic number 9, and that is that Abdullah ibn Masood actually refused to surrender his copy to the officials of Usman when they had come to gather it. And the way these narratives report, it clearly seems that perhaps Abdullah ibn Masood had a different version of the Quran with him, and that is why he refused to surrender something. And he actually said that he had learnt, or he had been taught 70 surahs directly from the Quran, and how can he give up something which he had directly learnt from the Prophet and give it away to the officials of Usman. So this is how these narratives have been reported. And while I was discussing topic number 9, I had pointed out that it seems to me that actually what happened was that as we have seen, that the Quran was given a final arrangement when it was complete. It also had an initial arrangement, so the Sahaba are bound to have both these arrangements with them, because initially the Quran was revealed the way it was. It had a revelatory sequence, and then there was a final sequence. And it seems that Abdullah ibn Masood, one of the oldest companions of the Prophet, actually had this earlier arrangement with him as well, and which he actually thought was a prized possession, because he had heard these surahs directly from the mouth of the Prophet. So he actually wanted to keep this as a historical record, knowing full well, of course, that this is just a historical record as far as the Quran is concerned. It has been given a new arrangement, and he did not want to give up that prized possession in which he had his own Mus'haf, which was at the time when the Quran was being revealed, and of course which might have a different sequence, not only in the verses within the surah, but in amongst the surahs themselves, and maybe it also had certain verses which were repealed. But then again, it was clearly a historical record which Abdullah ibn Masood wanted to retain with him, and he did not want to surrender. But the way these narratives are reported, they have given us an absolutely new form and new picture, as if Abdullah ibn Masood was insisting on a new Quran that he might have had. We also know that there are narratives in which Abdullah ibn Masood was present in the final review, the Al-Arza Al-Akhira. So he knew perfectly what the final arrangement was, because there are narratives which tell us that he was a witness to the Al-Arza Al-Akhira. So he perfectly knew the previous sequence, the previous historical revelatory sequence, and he knew what the final sequence was. The only reason which seems to me is plausible in why he refused to surrender his codices and also asked the people of Kufa to hide them was because he actually had that original sequence, which he knew very well that it would be changed. But because of academic purposes, because of his love of keeping a record of the previous revelation, he did not want to surrender it. So this, I would say, is the 11th question and the way I would go about answering it. The 12th question, viewers, is that we find there is a narrative in Ibn Abi Dawud's Kitab al-Masaif telling us that Hajjaj ibn Yusuf changed the Quran in its times at 11 places. This narrative had been shown while I was discussing topic number 11, that it is rejected by all authorities, and it not only has questions regarding its text, but also in its chain of narration, which is extremely weak and extremely unreliable, and it seems to be a concocted narrative, or at least a narrative which has been reported in a way in which facts have been distorted. Because if we analyze this narrative in the light of many other historical details, we find it seems that in times of Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, as was the case in the Caliph Usman's times, that like Usman destroyed many spurious Masaif, it seems that while Hajjaj ibn Yusuf was the governor of Iraq or Kufa in his times, he too took upon a massive campaign to destroy spurious Masaif, which he thought were there. And he even, as we know, Ibn Qutaybah has recorded that he actually constituted a committee of three people, Asim al-Jahdari, Najia ibn Rum, and Ali ibn Asma, to destroy all spurious masahif and pay the respective owners a compensation of 60 dirhams as well. So we find that, and then we have another narrative from Imam Baqilani in his Intisar, which actually says that the masahif of Kufa had 11 mistakes in them, which Hajjaj actually corrected. So it might be in all probability that this correction which Hajjaj made in the Kufan codices actually ended up as in the form of a narrative which depicts the fact that actually Hajjaj changed the Quran at 11 places. Perhaps what happened was he corrected the Quran or the Kufan, certain Kufan codices which were wrongly written. So, but this might be the real picture. But as far as the narrative is concerned, which tells us that the Quran was changed by Hajjaj, as I said, it is totally unreliable and has been wrongly reported. The 13th question, viewers, which arises is that we find that there are certain narratives reported by, for example, Ibn Zurais and by others in their Fazail al-Quran, which tell, and Abu Ubaid as well, that the Quran, the way it has been arranged, it has a certain sequence in which the first seven long surahs are called the Sabutiwal, then we have the Main surahs, then we have the Masani, and then we have the Mufassil surahs. And I had shown when I was discussing topic number 13 that not only the connotation of the words Main and Masani and Mufassil and even Tiwal, the connotation as well, is disputed among authorities. This narrative itself is extremely weak in its description to the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, and therefore this again cannot be entertained. The 14th and final question, viewers, which arises, is on the basis of a narrative in the Al-Jami' al-Sahih of Imam Bukhari, which seems to tell us, or at least there are scholars who think on the basis of this narrative that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ himself actually left behind a mushaf, a proper arranged copy of the Quran. And we have the famous Ustuwanatul Mushaf narratives in which it is said that the Prophet would seek out a particular pillar in his mosque where he would offer the optional prayers. And that was called the Ustuwanatul Mushaf, or the pillar of the Mushaf, signifying that a Mushaf of the Quran was placed near it and later perhaps withdrawn. But I had shown that this is actually a very wrong inscription. All the details which if gathered in this regard tell us, and this was when I was discussing topic number 12, that actually this Mus'haf is the one which Hajjaj ibn Yusuf had sent to the Prophet's mosque in Medina in his own times, and which was actually placed beside the pillar where Prophet Muhammad would offer his optional prayers. So it is like the details that come to light are that actually Hajjaj had sent a Mus'haf to the Prophet's mosque in Medina, the Masjid al-Nabawi, and had placed it at the pillar where the Prophet would offer the optional prayer, the Nafl prayer. And these are the details, but it has been erroneously interpreted by certain scholars that actually the Ustawanatul Mus'haf means the Mus'haf, the pillar of the Mus'haf, and signifying the fact that this was the pillar, or this was the Mus'haf which was placed at a certain pillar in the mosque of the Prophet and it actually is the same Mus'haf which the Prophet himself had compiled in his own time, and which he left behind, and which was in fact later destroyed by Marwan ibn al-Hakam. But more details can be looked up when you can see how I have analyzed them when I was discussing topic number 12. So viewers, these are the 14 questions on the basis of these narratives. Each of them, of course, is based on narratives which arise and which I have just briefly answered today in a very passing way. Have done so in much detail in the earlier topics. You can look them up. And finally, I would say, before we close this this topic, it's both the 19th topic, and go on, inshallah, to the next topic later on, that Faraiz view, the way it has been mentioned and the way it has been presented, is something which presents a new light on the collection scheme of the Quran. It is as if the correction of the Quran has been delineated by the Quran itself in the Meccan period. Surah Qiyamah is a Meccan surah. So much before the final Quran, or the final installment of the Quran, had been revealed, the Prophet and his companions were assured, in fact, by the Almighty that the various installments which are at the moment necessary, the Quran cannot be revealed in a single revelation or a single go because of various reasons. It has to be revealed in episodes, but the prophet shouldn't worry. All these episodes shall be brought together in a new sequence by the Almighty, and then that new sequence shall be read out to him, and he would be obliged, or he would be obligated, to read the Quran in, with its recital in the new sequence. And this actually, I would say is a groundbreaking interpretation which Farahi has offered, and it is very true to the words of the surah, the whole context of the Quran, but also we find history standing at the back, a lot of historical details, I would say, also actually telling us how this mechanism took place in the living tradition of the Muslims. So inshallah, in the next and final topic, we shall see how this collected Quran, the way we have just described, was transferred to the later generations, and ultimately how we as its recipients stand vis-a-vis its authenticity. So until then, أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم ولسائر المسلمين والمسلمات.